Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller is a medical oncologist specializing in pain and palliative care, and he serves as the Director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, we look at the growing field of psycho-oncology with Dr. Jimmy Holland. Dr. Holland is the Wayne E. Chapman Chair of Psychiatric Oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and begins with a description of the field.
What we mean by this area is the part of cancer care that deals with the psychological, the emotional reaction to this illness at all stages of disease, patient, the family, and the staff who have their own burden in taking care of this. There's a flip side to it, which is also what are the psychological, social, behavioral issues that impact on cancer incidence and survival. For example, smoking would be a good example. So we like to look at both sides of it, what cancer does to people and what people may do to influence getting cancer or surviving.
So along those lines, there was a feeling, and it was pretty well publicized in the press, this must be 10 or 20 years ago, that, you know, stress causes cancer. And if someone is saying, geez, you know, my family is a pain in the neck, that person would end up with head and neck cancer. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That was a very, I think, unfortunate part of our cultural adaptation to cancer or reactions to cancer, because there's always a tendency when you don't know the cause of a disease to blame somebody for getting it. Tuberculosis, for example, we used to think that had a psychological cause till we found the bacteria. Cancer's been much the same way, and I think it was such a shameful disease to have. You kept it a secret. You didn't talk about it. It led to the feeling, well, I must have done something awful to bring this on myself. And that added to the burden. Not only having the disease was one thing, but having it secretive and as if one had done some absolutely awful thing. And the society really sort of supported that. So we blame the victim very often.
Now, from your perspective, have we moved beyond that?
I think we've moved a long way beyond it, in part because we know the causes of cancer. We know cures for several cancers. And so as the knowledge about a disease improves, the mystique of it disappears. We have a microcosm of this with AIDS, where if you remember, it started in the early 80s. We were all frightened to death. We had no idea how you caught it, how you treated it. We knew there wasn't treatment. And within a decade, AIDS is now very much confined to certain kinds of behaviors. And people don't worry about getting it anymore.
Well, looking at the sort of the flip side of that, the things that people can do to manage stress, people participating in support groups, positive thinking, positive imagery, guided imagery, what role do they have in the process of getting better?
Well, let me speak first to positive thinking. I've called this the tyranny of positive thinking, because there's a sense out in society, if you don't think positive, you're letting your tumor grow faster. You're not helping yourself. And, you know, who can be positive when you're nauseated and That's vomiting true. And going through arduous treatments? Of course you're going to feel depressed and sad and nervous. So we would like to get away from that idea that positive thinking is good for some people, if that's your personality. But for others who are more cynical and quiet and reserved, putting that on them to say they have to be positive is another burden. So in terms of guided imagery, all the kinds of relaxation, meditation, all of these things are helpful techniques to some people. So there's no one-size-fits-all for coping with cancer. Some people like counseling. They like to talk about it, either with a counselor or with other people who have the same disease. But not everybody does. So we get into trouble when we say this is the one way to cope with cancer. So I try to say to families to respect how your person in the family is coping with it. That's best for them. We can't change people in the middle of the road. Mm-hmm. When you've got a disease, you look for the strengths the person has and you enhance those strengths. But you don't say, you're all wrong, you're coping the wrong way, move the other direction. It's not the time to do that.
Thinking, as you're talking, I'm thinking also that people have their own path and their own trajectory in terms of the illness, and so what may work for one person at one time, the illness may not be helpful That's during
true.
Another.
Very true. I think that the challenges change over time. The diagnosis is one set of problems. What's the best treatment? What's the best doctor? How do I get started treating this thing that's so scary that's just happened to me? As time goes on, it's how do you cope with the side effects of treatment? And then how do you cope with having it all over? Interestingly enough, when the treatments are over, people get a kind of paradoxical new level of distress. Oh, my God, I'm not getting treated. It could come back. The doctor isn't seeing me every week. These kinds of things are an adaptation to survival that we're beginning to know much more about and to realize there's a baggage that goes with being cured of cancer.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about that because, you're actually here this week at Yale as our keynote speaker for a survivorship conference. That baggage that people carry after cancer, can you give us some examples or tell us more about it?
Sure. I think the first thing is anyone who's ever had cancer has a niggling fear it could come back. And it gets less over the years, but it's always there. This disease is one that you can never be quite sure about. So the fear of recurrence is always there. Some people will have post-traumatic symptoms from the treatments, particularly something very arduous like bone marrow transplant, where they may have been isolated for a month or 6 weeks in the hospital with multiple infections and difficult treatment fevers. And they may think back on that and have nightmares, have anxious startle reactions to loud noises, really rather typical symptoms that Vietnam veterans we first observed. And coined this term, post-traumatic stress. So some of those symptoms can be around years later. We did see also, and not so prominent now, but conditioned nausea and vomiting, that if you get some patients, if they get a reminder of the chemotherapy that they had, like a smell of alcohol or even looking at a room that looks like the treatment, they can feel a little anxiety and a little sense of nausea, which is bringing back that old time when they were sick and getting chemotherapy. We see it less because the drugs we have to control nausea and vomiting are so powerful and effective today. That was a big, interesting problem that we observed 10, 15 years ago.
So let me ask you more about post-traumatic stress. Does that get labeled with other terms? So if someone with cancer, 6 months later, 12 months later is having a lot of these reactions, does that get called other things and misdiagnosed?
It probably isn't called post-traumatic stress. It's probably just patients themselves will say, I don't know why. I'm more worried now and more nervous now that the treatment's all over. I should be opening the champagne bottle, and I don't feel like that. I feel like I'm more worried than ever. So I think it comes across as what we'd probably call anxiety, reactive anxiety, maybe just some depressive symptoms. Probably would pass for that. But I think there's an aspect of that that's clearly post-traumatic.
And then on the flip side of depression, are people diagnosed with an anxiety mood disorder when in essence it's a reaction to stress?
Absolutely, it can be.
Yeah. I want to ask you a little bit about you. I know that you refer to distress as the sixth vital sign. So what does that mean?
Love to tell you about that. One of the things that's happened is that pain management has improved enormously in this country, and it improved essentially because the doctors begin to say, to ask a patient, how is your pain 0 to 10? And patients begin to get the idea, and while they didn't like it at the start, they can tell you definitely, my pain is an 8 right now, and it was only 2 yesterday. And there's a algorithm. If it's over 5, you have to get some new look at the pain management medications. So that became the fifth vital sign, that doctors have to look at blood pressure, temperature, respiration. But in addition, a fifth sign is pain, that you must ask about pain at every visit and pay attention to it. We have felt that the now most neglected area of care is what we've called distress, this whole psychological side. And because it is so neglected, it's never asked about, or often not asked about, in doctor-patient fast visits that are occurring today where most of the cancer care is. What we have proposed is just use the word distress. How is your distress level today, 0 to 10? And what we found is if patients say it's more than 5, that's a sign to ask some more questions. Well, why? What's going on? Is it that your son's on drugs at home? Is it that the cancer's bothering you? Whatever it is, we need to know it. And the oncology nurse or the oncologist could ask those questions, or the social worker if there were one in the clinic. So we have proposed that a sixth vital sign should be distress. After pain, how is your distress level, 0 to 10? This has been initiated in Canada, and they now have, across their cancer care guidelines, the sixth vital sign is distress. So the U.S. could learn something from Canada.
Well, so from what you've heard about and seen in the Canadian system, when patients are asked that, a large number of people with cancer, I mean, are they giving numbers 7, 8, 9, and 10, or is it really across the board?
It's highly variable. The numbers that are very high are quite low, but when they are, that's a red flag. This is someone who needs to be further explored quickly. So we try to use a very short question, just to a broad brush stroke, to find out, is this person distressed? Then we'll obviously want to go into why, and that's a second level. But this first level is very helpful. And many people say, no, I'm 1 or 2, or it's not worth talking about. Or you may find somebody says, yes, I'm scoring high, but I know why today, and I'll be fine tomorrow. So you have to go beyond that. But the number, part of the reason why this is helpful is that patients don't want to sound like they're a wimp. They don't want the doctor to think that they're not coping well. They're be embarrassed to say that I'm nervous or not sleeping or no sex, all of those reasons. And the doctor's busy, and he's not knocking himself out to ask more questions because he's got 25 people sitting out in the clinic. So the opportunity to talk about this is so limited, and the word psychological is so frightening to people that we hit upon the word distress, because obviously you're distressed if you have cancer. It's normal to be distressed, but you can be a lot distressed, and that's what we need to know. And so we feel that that's a better word than anything that's got psychological, certainly not psychiatric on it. That frightens people
right.
out
if
of their
you
wits.
Are you depressed? Are you anxious? Would those be terms that would have stigma?
I think they do. Unfortunately, they shouldn't, but they do. But distress is a very neutral word. And so that's how we came to use that as a vital sign rather than nervous or anxious.
Now, patients ask, because I think with pain it's fairly well understood. Are you in pain today? People can sort of rate that. But when if a patient were to look at you and say, well, what do you mean? Mm-hmm. How would you define it for them?
I would just say, I don't care what the feeling is. Just give me what it feels like, 0 to 10. If yesterday you were calm and okay, how are you today? And they can give you a number. And this has been validated around the world. It's being used in a lot of countries. And anything that's above about a 5 should be followed up. Patients are pretty good. They're more reliable than we used to think.
Well, we would like to remind you can email questions to us, to myself and Dr. Jimmy Holland, at canceranswers@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more information about the emotional side of cancer with Dr. Jimmy Holland from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center.
Here in Connecticut, the American Cancer Society estimates that almost 1,000 people will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer every month. The good news is that when you detect it early, colorectal cancer is easily treated and highly curable. That means that if you're over the age of 50, you should have regular colonoscopies to screen for this disease. In the case of patients that develop colorectal cancer, there are more options than ever before thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for colorectal cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm here with Dr. Jimmy Holland, who is a professor of psychiatry and director of psychiatric oncology at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Hospital. Jimmy, let's talk about the mind-body connection. I mean, that is, you know, it's a very popular thing to think and talk about, but what does that mean?
Well, I think that we live in a kind of can-do culture, so we'd like to think that our mind can control what's going on in our body. It's a very appealing idea, and that certainly appeal about cancer. And we went through an era in which there was the idea that if you could visualize your immune cells killing off the cancer cells, you were enhancing your immune function. I think that's more fantasy than reality. Clearly, the mind and the body are all in one mechanism, and they interact all the time. However, I don't think that there are psychological mechanisms that are going to alter cancer growth. Now, it's quite possible that psychological activities alter behavior, like smoking, and that in itself alters cancer risk. It's also true that our psyches have to do with whether we adhere to the treatment that the oncologist recommends. If you're there every day to get your radiotherapy, you're certainly going to have a better outcome than the person who says, not for me. I'm going to stay in bed today. So, yes, the psyche affects the cancer treatment, but by way of behavior, not by any kind of mystique or mysterious mechanism within the body that we've identified.
I have to say, it's very it's helpful hearing it from you as as an expert in this field. You've written a wonderful book. It's called The Human Side of Cancer: Living with Hope and Coping with Uncertainty. So let me ask you about that last part. How do people cope with uncertainty in this setting?
I think, Ken, that is the cornerstone of the illness, really, is for most people with cancer, they get the diagnosis, and it's very hard for the doctor to say, you're 100% cured, or you're 100% not cured, and you're not going to make it. But people live within a limbo in between of being hopeful, I think they got it, I'm hopeful they got it all, but with that uncertainty that they may not have. And so finding a way to deal with that uncertainty, putting it into a context that lets you go on with your everyday life and controls the fears and anxieties that everybody has, is really the essence of the coping. I had a wonderful young man who had a graphic way of telling me about it. He said, I have these three little gremlins in my head, Dr. Holland. One of them says, you're not going to make it, buddy. You're sick. And the other one on the other side says, come on, miracles happen. You're going to be fine. And I have this third little gremlin in the middle who has to keep the other two quiet so I can put one foot in front of the other and manage my daily life. That is graphically what I think happens as people cope with uncertainty.
I have to say, it's a wonderful analogy.
Isn't that a great analogy?
I'm
he
gonna
was
remember
a marvelous
that.
Young man.
So let me, you know, related to that, you know, one word that I think we'd never use in the clinic, I don't recall hearing it, is the word cure. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost like a dirty word. Mm-hmm. I mean, have you noticed that?
Well, and you know, I think that's a change. You used to talk about cure. Surgeons would say, okay, your breast is operated, goodbye, you're cured. And, you know, there was a kind of certainty about that was very appealing. Today, a woman gets all these statistics. Well, you know, you're 85% safe, but there's that 15%. So, therefore, we're going to see you every 4 months forever. I think that you don't walk away with the certainty that you used to in older days. Now, that certainty was not quite so certain as they gave you, but you had a kind of sense of, I'm all right for now. I think given today's very careful follow-up of people. It keeps the cancer in their forefront of their minds. And I see people who say, I get psychotic the week before all my scans, every 4 months, and I just know, I call it my pre-scan psychosis. Mm-hmm. And after the scans are over and it's negative, I'm fine again until the next scan. So, yes, we need to be following people, but I'm not sure sometimes, Ken, if we're not a little excessive with it.
Yeah, it honestly makes me wonder.
I think so.
Wonder as well. One of the biggest concerns that people have when diagnosed with cancer is their children. And their loved ones in general.
Yes.
What is your advice in terms of let's talk about children for a second, about how people should share this and can share this information with their child. Let's say it's a woman with breast cancer, in a way that may be best for the child and for all of them.
Well, it's a very important question. Sometimes the little ones are kind of neglected when one of the parents becomes ill. Our experience is that children do well as long as they feel they're on the team, that mommy is telling me just what's happening, I know what's going on. They do most poorly when it's a secretive thing, like something is happening and the child feels very excluded, and children will imagine the very worst rather than the best. And so parents are not really protecting the child when they keep the information at a distance. The child will do much better if he or she feels like, you know, mommy trusts me to tell me what's going on. If I'm going to the hospital, I'm going to have this little operation, I'm going to lose my hair. Yeah, it isn't going to be fun, but, you know, we'll get through it. And then the children feel they're all a part of what's going on, and they handle it well if they do.
And in terms of spouses and significant others, I mean, what have you seen in terms of how people can partner well together?
Well, we say cancer is a family disease. It affects not just the person who has it, but everyone around them. And I think a couple who have had a good marriage will probably get closer. If it's a troubled marriage at the time cancer occurs, can be very difficult with a lot of conflict, a lot of should we separate, but we need one another right now. It's a very difficult time when a marital situation is not very good. So we have a counseling center, and we offer family counseling. We offer counseling to children. And it's not, you know, a sign of weakness to ask for help. I think there's still this kind of stigma that, well, you know, asking for counseling or some kind of psychological help means I can't cope with it. I'm a wimp. Not true at all. We can help people sort out these things, help them deal with the issues in constructive ways rather than destructive ways.
People talk about the term post-traumatic stress, and there's also discussion of post-traumatic growth. So, well, what does that mean?
Well, that's a good point to bring up. I've certainly talked to people who said, you know, as bad as cancer was, I'm glad it happened to me because it changed my life. I stopped to smell the roses. I appreciate the little things. And so it really was a life-changing event for me. I now look for what it is I'm supposed to do. Why was I saved? And people will find all kinds of things they feel now they're going to do with their lives. Now, I have other people who say, that's a lot of garbage, you know. I don't think it changed my life at all, except in a not very good way, and I'm glad it's over and so much. So people perceive it very differently. But I do think that there are many people who, surviving a crisis, a car accident that brings you near death, any kind of near-death experience that's very frightening and that you survive, often brings people up short. Who am I? What's the meaning of life? What should I be doing? So it's not just cancer that will do this, but there is this sense of growing from crises. We all grow from negative things that happen to us, and nobody's got a life of all good things. So we use, I think, adversity oftentimes as a means of personal growth.
Recently, the Institute of Medicine, which is a very, very well-respected organization in Washington, issued a very important report on the emotional side and the psychological side of cancer. Can you tell us what their findings were? Because I want people to hear it and sort of know what they can expect.
I'm delighted to tell you about that. The Institute of Medicine carried out a 2-year study of what are the barriers to patients getting good psychological, psychosocial care in the course of their cancer treatment. And what we found is that probably people in the U.S. have the best cancer treatment in the whole world. But the psychological side of it, the support, the emotional support for it, is very poor. It's way, way lagging behind the medical, by the technical side of care. So the Institute of Medicine report says that there is strong evidence that the psychosocial is important in care, has been proven to be important by their interventions, and that bottom line, psychosocial needs must be integrated in routine cancer care if it is to meet quality standards today. That is a whole new world because we've never had that level of acknowledgement and support before. So while it's, you know, it's top-down kind of change, at least when there is a standard out there, it has an impact. It has an impact that can be followed up and implemented by recommendations for oncologists' office, how they must include in their workup of a new patient, how distressed are you? How much are you having trouble coping with this illness? And then to refer them. There are a lot of free resources in this country that are not used adequately, like, for example, the wellness communities. There are 20 of them around the country, totally free counseling help of all kinds. There's Gilda's Clubs. There's the National Coalition of Cancer Survivorship. All of these, American Cancer Society, all of these have free counseling by telephone, and we have our American Psychosocial Oncology Society has a helpline, which is 1-866-4-HELP. I'm sorry, APOS4HELP.
APOS, which is your organization.
Which is our society, APOS4HELP, which we will help you find a counselor in your own community that knows something about cancer and knows something about counseling.
So you're saying, whether it be in a community practice or an academic setting, people are entitled to that help, and it sounds like there often is help available.
It's available, and people need to know this is your right. It is a part of your care that has to be there to help you get through the illness in the best possible way.
So probably is our last question. I mean, you've been doing this for over 30 years. Do you find yourself more optimistic or less optimistic about getting those services out there to people?
I'm very optimistic. Things change slowly. We've seen the stigma of cancer diminish over the years so well that people now are not so frightened of it, still frightened, but they understand it better. I think the psychological side is still one that's a little stigmatized. People don't want to admit that they might need a counselor for, again, these reasons that we fear anything mental we still fear. So that, too, is improving, and I guess I'm an optimist, and I figure if we just hang in long enough, we'll finally get there.
Well, that's terrific. I want to remind our listening audience that survivorship programs like we have at Yale are available, but other cancer centers as well, that counseling services are available as well, and as Dr. Jimmy Holland was saying, that really is your right. Jimmy, I want to thank you for joining us on Yale Cancer Center Answers. Until next week, this is Dr. Ken Miller from the Yale Cancer Center wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, we'll discuss the process of helping spouses of cancer patients with Dr. Mario Lascalzo. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.